I read it from a reputable green team site. This is from theCelticsBlog.com, right, Murray?
Correct.
Okay. Bobby Manning wrote this the other day, and it was just a survey of the players that came out of the third lottery position. Not the third pick, but the teams that started with the third lottery position and what happened. He said,
This is Cousin Anthony. Welcome to the Bobcast.
I'm going to bomb this shit.
So that's where I got it from, Dave, just by the way.
Once again, sports and greater social issues are starting to hit an intersection that can't be ignored. This is David Zirn writing for The Nation. On Sunday, March 18th, a 22-year-old black man named Stephen Clark was killed by Sacramento police in his grandmother's backyard. They took his life with 20 bullets. Near Clark's body, there was a cell phone. After killing Clark, the officers muted their body cameras. On Thursday, following a week of protests, civil disobedience, and other actions, Black Lives Matter demonstrators marched, and their actions made national news across the sports pages. Yes, the sports pages. These protesters made the decision to surround the Sacramento Kings publicly funded basketball arena, the Golden One Center, preventing fans from attending the game. As police closed in, the team locked the doors, keeping all the fans out, with the exception of a smattering of people who arrived early or entered through a VIP entrance. The game was subsequently played in front of empty seats, the silence of the arena standing in for the silencing of Stephen Clark's voice. On Sunday, before the Kings tipped off against the Boston Celtics, players on both teams wore t-shirts during warm-ups with Clark's name on the back and the phrase, "Accountability, We Owe One," across the front. They kept the shirts on during the playing of the national anthem. Then, on the Jumbotron, the Kings and Celtics players played a public service announcement calling for police accountability. In the video, Celtics star Al Horford said, "We will not shut up in trouble." Word also got out that the former Sacramento Kings players, DeMarcus Cousins and Matt Barnes, even offered to pay for Stephen Clark's funeral. For some reason, it's tough to talk about these issues in sports circles, even though sports in general are supposed to be interconnected with life. Again and again, people take advantage of the rags-to-riches stories that a lot of athletes climb to the top on, and people have no problem talking about that, even though there's greater social issues at play there. But now, once again, we have a prominent death of an African American at the hands of police violence, stepping right into the backyard of major American sports. And the Kings haven't handled much right on the court over the last 10 years. I think anyone can tell you that. It's the running joke, Kings are gonna king. But how about that? You have a public disturbance going on outside the stadium, getting in the way of attendance at the games. It's already another horrible season for that team. And they had the awareness, the dignity, the wherewithal to acknowledge the anger of that community there, who is going through a lot right now, and dedicate a whole pregame ceremony to not saying, "Calm down, get out of the way, let us do our thing, let us basketball and move on." No anger from the Kings organization, or even silence from the Kings organization as this is going on their front lawn. Be one thing to denounce it, because that's making a stand right there. But silence is the easy way out, and I feel like that's the way a lot of people in their position, organizations in their position, would go in that circumstance. It's a very hotly contested issue. You're a team that interacts with the community. I'm sure they interact with the police department there. And even with all that as the backdrop, even with a sharply divided national conversation going on around the NFL, where its players have kneeled to this very issue. I mean, this is the issue right at the heart of what Colin Kaepernick's doing, and what has, by all accounts, kept him out of the NFL and brought the NFL debate all the way up to the office of the president, where he's commenting on it. So they are jumping into this situation with poise, with diligence. Not only are they doing it, but the Celtics reached out to them. Celtics are just dropping in for a day. This isn't in their backyard. They have nothing to do with this. And the Celtics even step in and make their statement known. Al Horford going up on the video board. Horford is no strong personality. He's a pretty neutral character there. You know, he's even keeled. He's not going to make a big stink about things. He does his job, goes in the building, goes out. Good teammate, good active player on the court. And even he felt the need to go on the Jumbotron and say, "We're not going to shut up and dribble." It says a lot. It says a lot to me about how athletes in general, not just the most outspoken ones, but even a player like Horford, they're fed up. They have positions in society that they feel like can make a difference when something like this happens. Stephen Clark, the video's out there. He was unarmed. He was in his grandmother's backyard. And he was killed. Multiple bullets. It's a lot. And I know there's lots of different arguments out there. Lots of different political rationales that people go off of. And it's, you know, people are getting entrenched in their positions on both sides of this, but at the end of the day, whether you're, you know, pro Black Lives Matter, pro police, the story here is that a man lost his life, a 22-year-old man. And that's something that, whether you're on this side of the issue or on this side of the issue, you at least have to treat with some sort of dignity, respect, carefulness, and especially sympathy for a grieving family and a grieving community. Not just the people who know him, but the people who relate to him are going to feel very strongly about this. And at the very least, a team that plays in a publicly funded stadium owes it to its community to let their voice be heard on an issue that just seems to completely reciprocate every few months. Big kudos to the Kings. They handled this one right. I'm Bobby Manning. This is episode 36 of the Bobcast. Today we're going to talk to John Corrales, who hosts the Locked On Celtics podcast. I'm always interested in talking to media people because, especially media people who have been in the media for a long time and worked in various different platforms, in his case TV and the internet, and he's had success in both of those. So I'm interested to see what changes he's seen over the years, how he's been able to create a show. Locked On Celtics, more than anything, is a show. It's not just a podcast. And we'll get into the difference between those two things. Damon Amendola really helped me understand the difference between those two things. So we're going to hear from John Corrales on hosting a show, on creating a platform, on just being in media in 2018 and what that entails. Let's talk to him now.
Today we have a special guest who has made a big impact on the Celtics media world. If you walk inside the Celtics locker room now, it's crazy how the internet media has taken over. It seems like there's more internet media people in there than there are newspaper people in there. And our guest today has been a big part of that. You'll see one of his colleagues in the Celtics games all the time from their podcast, which has become a hit in the Celtics media landscape. So let's not waste any more time. Let's bring him in. He is a journalist with Fox 5 in New York. He's the host and producer of the Locked On Celtics podcast and a co-founder, writer at RedsArmy.com. Also have to add a Boston sort of resident in that he went to Emerson College and graduated from there. So let's bring him in. He's John Corrales, and he is on the Bobcast today.
Hey, you want to keep doing the intro. I'm loving listening to this. This is great.
Yeah, people love the intro. I think it's the guest favorite part of the podcast.
Yeah, this is unbelievable.
You did get to play college basketball at Emerson College. I want to dive into that experience with you as we get into the beginnings of your career out there. What was your game like? What were some of your favorite memories playing in Boston?
Well, my game, when I was in college, I'll go back a little bit. In high school, my freshman year of high school, I was the worst player on earth.
Wow.
I was just horrible. I was
bold
horrible.
Self-criticism right there.
Oh, God. That was terrible. I was, at that point, a freshman in high school, I was like 6'3", but I was 250 pounds of just soft nothingness. I couldn't do a push-up, nothing. So it took me a long time to kind of develop a game. But I grew up in Rhode Island, and in Rhode Island at that point, 6'3", I grew up to, I'm 6'5" now. So I grew a little bit at that. You're big, you're on the post. And back then, my high school coach, luckily Roger Berard, shout out to Roger. He said, look, you can't coach height, and we're going to turn you into a basketball player. And so he got me involved at the Providence College basketball camps. And I was around those guys for a long time. He brought players. He brought guys from Providence College into our practices to play with me specifically. And I developed into, in my early playing days, more of a post player, you know, drop step, up fake, up and unders, stuff like that. So I would be back to the basket mostly. And then as I grew up and I got my, you know, coordination down, by the time I got to college, I moved to the four, and I could face up a little bit. And my game was mostly either posting up or running screens with the other big and flashing, reading where the defense was going, and either flashing baseline or flashing up and catching, and, you know, elbow jumpers and stuff like that. Not a ton off the dribble, not a ton long range, until like my senior year, I started to try to expand it a little bit. The kick in the ass is that after I was done playing, I played at Emerson. I played for one season in Greece before my body fell apart. And then they say your athletic prime is like 27.
Mm-hmm.
I was like 27, 28 years old, playing in men's leagues around Massachusetts. And all of a sudden, things started to happen. I was like, I suddenly became super coordinated. Like, our coach in college tried to teach us the Euro step, but back then it wasn't called the Euro step. He would put a chair in the middle of the lane and he'd say, dribble hard at the chair, step this way, step around it, and lay it in. And I just could not grasp it. I could not. And we called it the chair drill. Me and my buddy Ken, we're like, what the hell does he want us to do? Could not grasp it. Fast forward to like 27 years old. So now like 6 years later, I'm playing in Watertown at some men's league, and now at that point, I've developed a handle. I'm kind of running the point a little bit, and I'm bringing the ball up, and I'm driving at this guy, and I just whip off the Euro step and I lay it in. Like, I didn't even think in my mind, hey, I'm going to Euro step this guy. I just did it. And my buddy Ken from college was on my team. And as I was running back, I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he goes, chair drill. So my college days, I did all right. I did play pretty well, and I put up some pretty decent numbers at Emerson. But I wish I could have 27-year-old me in college, because 27-year-old me suddenly could handle a ball, could suddenly shoot the ball, and was playing more of a wing position than when I was playing in college, which was more of like a four, sometimes three kind of position.
That's a great story, the chair right there. Emerson, that was a place I wanted to go. I was looking at it my senior year in high school. Small school, very small school compared to some of the other ones I was looking at, especially Syracuse, where I am now, day and night in size. What was it like? You studied journalism there, I'm sure, right?
Yep.
What was it like studying journalism, getting involved in journalism in a small school community right there? Obviously, you're in a big city, but what were you able to learn there that kind of made that experience unique for you? And what did you pull from your time there education-wise?
Well, I think Emerson, the thing with Emerson is very hands-on. And when I was going to college, my decision came down to Syracuse or Emerson.
Ah.
And I was so close. I was so close to going to Syracuse, man. They gave me an awesome package to go to Newhouse. And I just ultimately, I just wanted to go to school in Boston rather than up in, as Aaron Baines would say, whoop, whoop, and be in the middle of nowhere. So I decided I wanted to be in Boston. Like I said, it was a 45-minute bus ride home, so I could always just go home and see my family or whatever. So it was just easier for me. And it obviously worked out very well for me, I think. And the Emerson experience is a lot more hands-on. And the kids now have much more advanced equipment than we did. But look, as a TV person, I was out there. I had a camera, you know, a professional-grade camera on my shoulder going out to shoot. I had editing equipment that I learned how to edit. I was on TV. We did projects in a real control room. I learned what not to do as much as I learned what to do. I made mistakes. Now I've been in the television business for over 20 years, and I think about some of the things. I still have vivid memories of making horrible rookie mistakes, and afterwards the professor going, okay, do you understand why that was very bad for you to do? Like, yes, I get it.
What was the worst one, you think?
The worst one was, so for people to understand, when you have in a television production, a live television production, so say, you know, whatever, like NBA pregame show, whatever, you have the anchor. The anchor has an IFB, which is the earpiece, and people in the control room can talk to the anchor if necessary. Really is only two or three people, depending on the situation: the producer, an executive producer who's up there, some sort of supervisor, and perhaps the director, who may have, like, say, in a quick instance, what camera to look at. So basically only three people. You can't have everybody talking to the person in his ear. And I think I'd killed a story. Another thing that happens in a television production, you have a plan, and sometimes things run short or long. So on the fly, we're killing or adding things because you have to fill the time. Mm-hmm. It's not like a newspaper that can be 20 pages. You know, this section is 20 pages. My show goes on at 6 p.m. and it's done at 6:27:30. Like, that is down to the second. It's everything is timed out to the second. So you have to make sure that time is full. While I had killed something, and the talent was reading something, it didn't get to him, and he was reading. And as he was talking, I got into the IFB, and I just screamed in his ear, "No!" And he froze on TV. And I was like, And then I gave him no direction. He was like, looking around like he had just seen a ghost, like, well, what do I do now? And then finally I was like, okay, next story. And we advanced the teleprompter and all that stuff. But the lesson there is, don't yell in the anchor's ear while he's talking. Figure something else out as a producer. So that was probably my most egregious error. I'll always remember that, and I'll always remember the look on his face. In fact, I worked with him once in Boston at WBZ. He came in, and I was like, "Hey, John, what's going on?" And, "Hey, remember that time?" He's like, "Yeah, I remember that time."
You always remember the worst moments.
I remember you, you jerk.
So you've worked in local news for 20 years, like you said, on WBZ, WNBC, Fox Now. I've talked to Ty Ray about his experience in that field. He was an anchor out in Denver for a period, and he said the field has changed quite a bit over the years, and you've been in the field for those decades to see those changes. What are some of the biggest changes in local news that you've seen?
Well, I think the biggest change is the influence of social media and the internet. It's just been amazing to think. Like when I first started, this was WMUR in Manchester, New Hampshire. And we had one computer. It was in the studio that had the internet. So if you wanted to use the internet, you'd have to go into that one computer and use Netscape Navigator.
My head.
That's dating myself. Yeah, because you're a college kid and you have no idea what the hell I'm even talking about. So we had to rely on news feeds. So at that station was an ABC station. So when you're an affiliate of a station, you have a service that the ABC, CBS, NBC, they have a news feed service that basically collects stories from around the country and feeds them out to everybody. If you want to use them, whatever. So wildfires in Los Angeles, the LA station, they take the video from them and they put it on the feed, and you sit there and you say, "Oh yeah, I want to run a story on the wildfires. Here's the video," and you grab it. So we had to rely on that, and we had to rely on the AP, the Associated Press, to tell us kind of what was happening. Now the internet, the first thing that happens if there's breaking news, if I find out like there's a terror attack, there is the guy who tried to bomb a subway. And so we get the scanner traffic. That's usually the first indication, you know, NYPD or Boston Police. The scanner traffic starts going wild. And everybody at our assignment desk goes, "Okay, something's cooking." As soon as we start to hear a couple of details, the first thing we do is we go onto Twitter. We go onto Twitter to see who's tweeting about it. We go onto Instagram or Facebook to see, because people instantly share things on social media. And now we don't report what they say, but it gives us guidance. It lets us know how serious. If I can't tell you how many times I've heard something is happening and I've hopped on Twitter and for like 10 minutes, there's nothing going on. I'm just like, people aren't tweeting about this. It can't be a big deal. And it wasn't. And then you hear about the subway thing and you get onto Twitter and all of a sudden people are tweeting like crazy. You're like, okay, this is going to be big. And you start to kind of get a sense of what your reaction is going to be. So social media, you know, if there's ever any sort of thing that happens around you and you go onto social media and somebody's got a video of a bomb going off or a car crash or whatever, underneath that post is a million TV stations. Do we have permission? Can we get permission? Can we get permission? And you have to get permission now and all that stuff because these people hold the rights to it and companies have come in and they've created they'll buy the video from the person who shot it, pay them a fee. Now they're the rights holders. And they sell the rights to that video to the TV station.
So there's a race to those videos, huh?
Absolutely. Any sort of viral video that you see, you know, a baby flips off the mailman, you're like, "Oh, that's hilarious." Chances are there's a company that's already bought that video and if anybody wants to use it, they have to pay a fee to use that. So that company comes in and says, "Hey, Bobby, we saw your video. That's hilarious. Here's $500. You want it?" You go, "Yeah, sure. $500. I got it." And then they turn around and they sell that thing for $500 to that TV station. And they turn around and they make thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars off of your video. And they have systems in place that will help make your video go viral. They understand the mechanisms. They say this has the potential to be a viral video. So they buy it before it really has blown up. And then they put it into their network. And they make it blow up, and then they turn around and sell the rights to use it.
So alongside your local news career, how did you end up branching off into the internet media as you have? Red's Army, of course, was probably a big part of that when you founded that, helped find that. There's a lot of Celtic sites out there. Each of them kind of have their own little voice, theme, identity to them. What was the vision for Red's Army going in, and how did that develop over time?
So I think it was we just had our 11th anniversary, I think it was. It's a long time, man. That's this. You're starting to wonder if it's time to put this dog down at this point on the internet. 11 years on the internet is a long time. But so Chuck McKinney and I were working at WBZ, and Chuck and I played basketball together briefly at Emerson. So we'd known each other for a little while, and we reconnected at WBZ. We're producing morning news there, and at that point, Boston Dirt Dogs was a very, very popular blog. And so we were reading that. And I just remember one day we were reading it and just laughing our asses off. They did a lot of Photoshop stuff and all that. And they were just their style was just fit us perfectly. And we said, we should do this for the Celtics. And then it just clicked. We're like, wait a minute. Yeah, we should do this for the Celtics. And so we kind of got a little plan together and we created a site. That was back then, there was no blogging software. You can't just open up WordPress or whatever and just create a post and it just automatically populates onto this awesome looking site. We had bare bones, like an editor that you had to, like, everything was in boxes. And if you wanted to post something, you have to physically delete a box and then post something at the top. So there are no archives really. And we just basically goofed around for a little bit. And we basically did a lot of Photoshopping, and we, you know, just had a lot of fun. And at that point, we started looking around and see Celtics Blog was around, and they kind of played it straight. And Celtics Hub was, I think, at that point starting to come up. And, you know, Zach Lowe, very analytical. And so we kind of thought, you know, as a third option, we could be the kind of goofballs. And so we were goofing around for a long time. We spent years like that, and then we just never stopped. I guess we could have stopped many times, and we had opportunities. There were times when we almost sold the site, and that ended up falling through. And now the site has evolved to what you see now. It's a lot of, you know, we still have fun. We still try to be a little irreverent. Obviously, when I'm writing things called your morning dump, you know, like we come up with these goofy ideas like, well, we need to do a link dump. So, yeah, we're going to dump all of the links of the day here and we're going to call it your morning dump. It's the link dump. And like, whatever. And it just stuck. It just stuck. And we've been doing it every damn day for years now. But as the years have gone on, different things have changed in my life, and I've just always kept the basketball thing as a side thing, but it's not even really a side thing. It's a thing.
Yeah.
It's not, I shouldn't call it a side thing. It's one of my things.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've progressed, I've turned it into more of a serious endeavor for myself. Like I think that, I want it to be a place where we can write, we can analyze things, we can have fun, but it's a supplement. Like, we're part of the ecosystem. And I think that if somebody is a Celtics fan, we're not stupid enough to think we're going to be the only place that people go, but we want to be one of the places that people go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you got the podcast, people listen to us, people listen to you, people listen. If they don't listen to us, they don't. Then that's fine. Not everybody's going to listen to us, although I wish that they would. But please, everybody, listen to us on Lockdown Celtics. No, but but look, people will make their choices, and maybe they like my writing, but not my talking, or maybe vice versa, or maybe they don't like any of it, and that's fine too. But I just hope that we can continue to be a part of Celtics fans' experience. Like I want to help, you know, enrich the entire thing. I just love the fact that social media has allowed this, that is, you know, the internet has allowed us to blog and tweet and talk and people now, when they watch a game, you're not just watching a game. You're getting a bunch of different people that give you information or jokes or, you know, the right animated GIF at the right time or whatever it is. And so, like right now, this is, I'm happy where we are. And I know I was joking around earlier about being around for 11 years, but there's one constant in my life amongst a ton of changes over those 11 years. And it's been the Celtics basketball, Reds Army, and the stuff I've been doing for that.
It's very, I'm glad you mentioned the fact that there's so many options out there in the Celtics community and there's all these different platforms. It is interesting that mindset that you put out there that, you know, some people are going to enjoy what I do, some people are going to go to other places. That's sort of present across all these different platforms that you see out there. Like, there's not a lot of intense rivalry or, you know, competition between the different people who put Celtics coverage out there. At least that's what I've seen. How do you feel about that? Because it seems like in other areas, things can get bitter, things can get angry between people in the same space, but you see people collaborating across platforms in this area. I mean, you're on my show right here. We're in two different sides of Celtics coverage getting along. It's an interesting dynamic that I've seen in this ecosystem particularly.
I think in general, the internet can be a place, especially amongst like-minded people, that it can be a place where we can all kind of coexist. And I always say, like, nothing is universal. Like, nothing is, I am not, even if I someday become, like, if we're going to rank them somehow, if I become the most popular of the group, that's still not 100%. If I'm the least popular of the group, that's still not 0%. Mm-hmm. There's nothing is universal. And there's always going to be some tension between people in the same space. There's always going to be a little something. So, you know, I've experienced some of it. It happens, whatever. You try to get past it. Some people rub you the wrong way. I rub some people the wrong way. I'm very sure of that. So that's it. That's fine. Again, nothing is universal. Some people think I'm an asshole. So be it. That's, you know, I can only be, as Brad says, the best version of myself that I can be. And, you know, I'm not always great at it, but, you know, whatever. I try my best. So, but I've seen this, like, I compare it to, like, the craft beer industry, which I've done a little bit of writing and I cover them a little bit. And I've seen there's always a competition. The craft beer industry, I see a lot of parallels to the blogging and this type of stuff. Because everybody wants to kind of grow. Everybody wants a little bit of money. Like, if you could get paid to do your podcast and just that be your life, like, that'd be awesome, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would love it. But That may mean that you're going for the same listeners I'm going for, and people got to make a choice. So there's some competition there a little bit. You want to, like, I want to make my show good enough for everybody to listen to. You want to make your show good enough for everybody to listen to. So there's a little friendly competition going on there. And, like, amongst the craft brewers, everybody's got their little corner. Everybody's got their little brew. And they got competition, too. Like, I want people to come and drink my beer. He wants people to come and drink his beer. That, you know, whatever. And, but they will often collaborate as well. And they – because in the end – all they want to do, everybody just wants to make good beer. And they don't have to just drink my beer. If they come to your place one day and my place the next, and we both make good beer, there's no reason why you can't both give people good beer. That's prevalent in the craft brewing community, with some outliers again, but that's the general philosophy that I've seen. It's kind of like that in this space. It's generally, I want to do something that's really good, and I hope people like it and enjoy it and consume it, and you do something that's really good and people enjoy it and consume. There's space, there's room for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I feel. And maybe, like I said, maybe somebody decides, I'm sick of John, I'm just gonna listen to Bobby. Then all right, that's cool, that's fine. You know, hopefully that just means somebody else along the way finds me for the first time, and they stick around with me for a little while until they're sick of my act, and then somebody else new comes along. But whatever, it's I think there's room for a lot of people to give a lot of different perspectives, because, you know, we're all watching. Last night, the Celtics played the Warriors, and what happened on the floor happened on the floor, but everybody's got a different take on what happened on the floor. You didn't see two different games, but there are two different takes or three different takes, which is amazing. We're all watching the same thing. We all come away with different thoughts. So there's got to be a place for all those thoughts to exist.
Love the analogies tonight. And I don't think anyone has given up on John for Bobby yet, but maybe one day. Let's get into Locked On Celtics. That's what the people have been waiting to hear about tonight, the story of that show. It's really grown substantially since it started in 2015. So I want to hear how it began, how you, Jay, Jam got together and started this whole thing that's been running game after game since that season. It was a weird time in Celtics history, too. That was when I really started getting going, covering the team on a full-time basis. You had the first half of the year, just complete crap as the year before it was, and then the second half of the year, things started going in the strong direction and it hasn't stopped rising since. So I'm sure that podcast has had a wild ride over that span, too.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I've always loved doing a show. Like, that's just one of my favorite things. So Chuck and I did a show. We called it the two-man game. But, you know, he wasn't always available. And for a brief, you know, hot minute, I was doing Celtic Stuff Live with John Duke. So they were on Red's Army, or, you know, he was the only member at that time broadcasting. So I did Celtic Stuff Live with him for a little while. And that was about the time we were talking about the Paul Pierce trade to the Brooklyn Nets. So that was our era there. And then I love to talk, as if people can't figure that out from me just yammering on this whole time. I love to talk. Like, it's so much easier to talk than it's typing, because like my thoughts just, like, I can't type fast enough for my, let me say it. Let me just tell you what I'm thinking. So, I've always wanted to do shows. I've done them for a long time. And so Jay King was thinking, like, on Mass Live, that he wanted to do something. And Jay contacted me. It's like, we've always had a good rapport, Jay and I. I've known him for a while. And we tried to do, like, a video element with whatever. And we were doing just the regular weekly podcast. And then David Locke, who is the radio play-by-play guy for the Utah Jazz, got in touch with us a couple years ago and said, hey, I've got this idea. I'm getting people together. We're doing a podcast for every NBA team and every NFL team right now. We want you to be our Celtics guys, and we're going to do it 5 days a week. We're going to give people a show every day, and we're going to just – we're just going to keep like make it part of their daily routine. And that's why I say that in my intros to the show, that we want people every day to go out and whatever you're doing, you go to the grocery store or you're getting in the car, just make it a habit. You download us and you listen to us. And if you've got a long commute, you can listen to other people too, but you just make us a part of your daily thing. And so, sorry about that. So we said, yeah, sure, that sounds good. But doing a daily podcast can be a grind. And so we definitely needed another person. So I remember listening to Sam Packard on the WEEI podcast, and that went away. And so Jay and I talked, and we're like, Jam fits our personalities. I mean, he's an easy guy to slide right on in. I think we can kind of get the same type of chemistry that we have. And so we said, we invited him on. He was like, yes, we will do this. Absolutely. So while Jay, most post-game shows are me and Sam, and then most non-game night shows are me and Jay, with the occasional crossover when one of us is just, you know, all potted out for the week and we want to take a night off. But that's kind of how we all came together.
I like how you call it a show, too, because it does transcend a podcast. A lot of podcasts you hear, people just flip the switch and it's just talking for the 40 minutes or whatever so you're there for. You guys have a lot of, you know, recurring segments, different things that come in. You got Jay and the Zaza. You got the Raining Jays. You got the intro there. It really has become a show. And you seem someone who is, you know, skilled in crafting shows. How much of that did you think about, and how much do you think it just naturally occurred between you three and your personalities that it became what it has in 2018 here?
I think, we definitely have a very good rapport, because there's not a ton of show prep going on. Like, we're not scripting out a ton of questions. We have, I've got written on my clipboard in front of me. I've got 6 words written. I have game reaction, trade stuff, Rozier, Zendaya. Those are our 3 topics for the show. And I don't like to go through a lot of pre-game, like pre-show stuff. We're going to talk about this. What do you think you're going to say? Whatever, like that. I don't like doing that because I don't have to with him, first of all. And if I did have to with anybody, I would. But I like organic reactions. I don't know what he's going to talk about. I don't know how he's going to react to certain things. I have an idea because I know him, but I just have an outline of these are the big topics. And if you're paying close attention like we do, like you and I and everyone else that does this stuff, we know what all the big topics are. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to really go into a lot of explanation. Just like, okay, Kyrie did this. Kyrie said this after the game. Al Horford did this. And we're just going to talk about it. And then the show just becomes 2 or 3 guys talking like they would talk at the bar. And I think that's what makes it effective, because it's just organic, natural reactions, nothing forced. When we bust each other's balls, it's all in good fun, and it's just natural. We don't purposely set each other up for it. It's just when it all comes naturally, I think it works, and hopefully that's what people are responding to.
All right, last question of the night coming your way. We build you up to the fastball. This is the tough one. This is the one you got to hit out of the park here. What I've pulled from this interview with you, it's interesting. You came up in this era where it wasn't easy to work in media technology-wise. Like you said, you had to pull these different things from these databases to work in the local news initially. You had to build Red's Army from the ground up when there wasn't that WordPress. Now that you've run into this era where you can just throw whatever you want on social media, you can easily throw the podcast up day to day, that's what I'm coming up in. You know, I never had to experience those things that you were in those era, but how do you think it impacted you as a media guy yourself that you did have to come up in that era where it was just a little bit harder to get your stuff out there to now adapting to this new era where it's easier, I'd say?
Well, I mean, I love that it's easier. I like to think that I adjust well to it. Like I see that it's coming, and I'm not going to fight it. But look, everybody's got the same type of story. Like this thing that's easy for us now, you're in college, and in 20 years, you're going to say, oh God, I remember I had to go through WordPress to put this up. Like, and now I just think about it and it appears or whatever. Like, who knows? Technology just goes so fast that you have to be open. And I fully believe in the adage, evolve or go extinct. You can't, no matter, and I try to approach everything the same way. I'm not approaching my writing or my podcasting or my life any differently. I have to evolve, understand what's happening in this world, whatever world it is, and evolve and react properly to that. So this new stuff, like whatever new social media thing is out there, I gotta just kind of get on board with it or whatever. So it's easy, and it's great that it's easy. It allows me to do multiple things in my life, and I enjoy a lot of that. And whatever's next is next. And you know, like I said, you're going to experience something down the road. You're going to say, oh, wow, I can't believe this got this much easier. And so this is going to be an interesting time. I really do think we're in a kind of a revolutionary time, because I saw the newspapers give all of their content away in the early days. Like now you have the BostonGlobe.com and Boston.com, but originally it was just Boston.com, and it just all the Globe stuff was on the website. And then people are like, I'm not going to buy a subscription to the Globe because you're giving it to me for free right on the web. And that's one of the biggest mistakes they've ever done, because now everybody expects things for free. And it's a bit ridiculous. Like, people will think nothing of going and dropping like $3 on a candy bar or, you know, whatever. You spend money, you drop $5 on something, you don't even think about it. But if I ask you to pay $1.99 for a week's worth of content, people are like, what are you, nuts? how many times have people tried to look at an app and say, oh, it costs $2.99? I'm not paying for any apps. You know, we want our apps to be free, even though they're super cheap. We want them all to be free, and we want our content to be free. And that is suddenly starting to change because people are now.
I see that too.
Putting their stuff behind paywalls. This Patreon is starting to catch on. More companies are putting their stuff behind paywalls and saying, look, you're going to have to pay us for this. And people are out there, I don't want to say it's stealing, but like this whole internet, I'm not going to go on a huge, huge rant here because I know we want to wrap up the show. Mm-hmm. But, you know, advertising, the people who are advertising on the internet don't know a damn thing about the internet because they just, their responses to people not clicking on ads is to make them bigger and more in your face, which doesn't make people want to click on the ads. It makes them find ways to make those ads go away. So now ad blockers are the big thing. And now there's a reaction. Now I go to a site, my workplace automatically just put ad blockers on our web browsers. And we didn't know that. So we go to a site and it says, oh, we see you have an ad blocker. You can't see the site without disabling your ad blocker. So there's a big reaction now. You have to see the ads. And there's, I think the next step here is you're going to have to start paying for content, which is going to make some people go away because some people are just going to be like, I'm not going to do this if I'm not getting paid. Everybody's getting paid. I got to stop doing this. And they're just fewer and fewer outlets. Things keep shutting down. How many sites have we seen shut down over the past few months? They just can't sustain it. And there are a lot of people who are very talented at what they do, and they can't make it. And in a lot of ways, this is like the basketball that we cover. There's 400 or so players in the NBA, and there are probably thousands more that could easily be one of the last three guys on anybody's bench. And they're never going to do it. They're never going to do it. They're going to have to find someplace else, or they're going to have to go into coaching, or they're going to have to do something else, because that's just the crap luck that they can't break through. And for whatever reason, they can't do it. And that's going to be some of us in this space too. There's only so many spots, and especially now as we continue to go down the road of people having to pay for the content and pay more and more for their content, there's only going to be so much money they're going to be willing to spend. So some people are going to be kind of falling by the wayside as this continues. So we're in a different era. You're a very interesting case, you know, guys your age, because it's going to be interesting to see how this impacts you, what work's going to be available for you, and how many people your age are going to be able to say, instead of doing this little piddly stuff and trying to freelance my way through life, I'm just going to go get another job, and you move on. Like, it could be interesting to see how many people have the passion to stick with this, and how many people say, I'm just moving on, doing something else.
Some James Young shade in that last answer, I see. I'll give it a home run. Last answer, out of the park. That's John Corrales, everybody. Thanks for being here on the Bobcast.
Thanks for listening, guys. It feels really good to be back. I'm going to be 100% honest. I have really been neglecting this show, as I said yesterday, when we talked to Sean Keeley. And we talked about pizza and other weird things I had on my mind. I'm excited to use this as a platform to just say how I feel about things, honestly and candidly. And be able to have that as something I can use 3 days a week to just let loose on what me, my friends, people I know, mentors, and everything else honestly want to say and talk about. So that's what we're going to do. You can find the Bobcast weekly tour of sports and pop culture on iTunes and the CLNS Media mobile app. As I said, Tuesday to Thursday, we're going to have guests. We're going to have friends calling in. Hopefully you'll get to know them a little bit. We'll have friends here in the studio. I know a lot of talented people here on campus we can talk to. Only other thing I want to say before we get out of here today is Marvin Bagley just declared for the NBA draft. Surprisingly not the youngest guy in this draft, because he is technically still a high school senior, but he's on the older end of that stick. So it's not surprising that he reclassified, went to Duke when he should have been a high school senior, and now when he should be going into his freshman year for the one and done, he's going to the NBA where he will be a top three pick. With this guy, there's probably little doubt about the fact that he would have been a top 5, 10 pick. The way he plays above the rim, how tall he is, how agile and aggressively he plays. I know the old heads don't like to hear about how aggressively a guy plays, because back in the day, everybody played aggressively. I heard that today. I think Kenny Smith said that. I don't want to misattribute who said that, but there was a story about our friend Bagley, who I think is going to be the best player in this draft. And the Oregonian published a story about how Bagley had played in a sneaker tournament, a sneaker-sponsored tournament. And even though the Bagley family filed for bankruptcy in 2008 with a combined annual income of $44,000, after the Nike sponsorship, the Bagley family moved to Southern California, and tax filings observed show that they live in a gated community where rents in the area range from $2,500 to $7,500 per month. Nike has said it provides some financial support to teams competing in its elite youth basketball league, according to Oregon Live. So we have word that Bagley probably got paid to play in a high school tournament that geared him towards certain people in recruitment that probably eventually led him to Duke University. And this is supposed to be a controversial story, an investigative story. The Oregonian sent in its investigative reporters in to uncover the details that a basketball player got paid to play basketball. We cover things here in the media through the lens of the system, the way things are supposed to work, as currently constituted, is how we decide whether things are good or bad. And I think sometimes we associate people negatively for doing things that, if you had a very honest debate, maybe aren't that bad. I think Twitter's really good on calling out outlets for doing that when they do take that angle on things. It's hard to say that Bagley going from bankruptcy to living the good life is a bad thing, unless you're either A, jealous of him, or B, really invested in the system that probably doesn't have many years left on it. A lot of people are calling BS on the fact that players should be able to profit off their likeness. The shoe companies are profiting off them. They're putting the logo on them that they're going to carry for life. These coaches, some of whom are the highest paid state employees in their respective states, they're getting that cash. And whenever this conversation comes up, it's a logistical battle. Oh, this won't work. That won't work. Well, all those things are probably going to come out in the wash. We have an FBI investigation that a lot of people probably aren't happy about. The fact that we are now committing journalistic resources and even worse, federal resources into investigating players getting money from people who are making money off them. We all praise economics. We love the capitalism system. Some of us. But it seems like those are the same people who don't want to be consistent in that because they love their college basketball. If you got rid of the one-and-done rule, I'm going to assume Marvin Bagley would be a NBA draft pick out of high school. And give him his due credit, you college basketball fans, because he went to Duke, he competed his ass off, drove that team deep into the NCAA tournament, deep into the ACC tournament. So there's some extra games he gave you on top of the regular season where he was the best player in the ACC bar none. And we're supposed to act like it's a controversy, a negative thing that he got paid or allegedly got paid back when he was a high schooler. Just because the head of the NCAA, who did not have enough information to comment on the Larry Nassar scandal, would rather die than see student athletes get called anything but. That's my word. I'm Bobby Manning. This is episode 36 of the Bobcast. We'll see you on Tuesday.
So that's where I got it from, Dave.
Bobcast.